This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Ghostbuster's Daughter, Life with My Dad, Harold Ramis. Written and read by Violet Ramis Steele. With a foreword read by Seth Rogen.
Foreword. Hi, this is Seth Rogen. I first met Harold Ramis at the Deauville Film Festival in 2005 when I was 23. Before you start thinking I'm fancy, just know it's kind of a bullshit film festival that's mostly like an overblown press event where they get Americans to come to the beach in France to show and promote their movies. By then I had been working as an actor and writer for a while and had met a lot of famous people and entertainers I grew up loving, but Harold was the first person I met who'd made the movies and TV that my parents also loved. I knew they were the funniest movies, even though I didn't get all the jokes, because we were all laughing together. Because they were the first movies I remember people quoting and making themselves laugh to hysterics at the mere thought of the scenes they hadn't actually seen in ages. Basically, the movies that made me want to make movies. Also, as an unconventional-looking, deep-voiced comedian with aspirations of writing, directing, producing, and acting, I couldn't always find a lot of people to look up to. People who let you know that there's actually a chance you can succeed. To me, Harold was that guy. He was the first person I knew who actually gave me hope. I'm Canadian, so SCTV was a fixture in my life since I can remember, and so was Harold. I remember as a kid being like, Egon also wrote Ghostbusters, and Meatballs, and Animal House, and directed Caddyshack, and Groundhog Day. It both blew my mind and made me think that maybe someone like me could find a way to make a living doing the same things. So I'm in France with Judd Apatow, and he has this thing where he shamelessly gloms onto people he's a fan of. I kind of have a never-meet-your-heroes thing. I still cringe at some of the interactions I've had with some of my favorite filmmakers, and I'm pretty sure George Lucas would avoid me if he saw me to this day. But Judd has the exact opposite instinct. He seeks out his heroes and barnacles himself until forcibly removed. So, Judd knocks on the door of my hotel room and is like, Harold Ramis is here. I met him once or twice. Let's find him. We heard that he was at the other hotel, the one that was much nicer than ours. We went over to the restaurant in the lobby, and there he was, with a huge smile on his face, prayer beads hanging off his wrist, giving interviews to promote his new film, The Ice Harvest. We waited until his interview was over and basically sat ourselves down beside him as though we were the next scheduled journalists. He remembered Judd, thank God, and talked to us for like an hour, telling stories and being cool. He invited us out to the fanciest restaurant I'd ever been to in my life, and that night, he not only showed me what a tasting menu was, he showed me that I can meet my heroes and not have it be a total disaster. They can be nice and gracious and everything I'd hoped they'd be. It should probably be said that pretty much every other hero I've met since then has totally sucked. About a year later, Judd and I were filming Knocked Up and needed someone to play my dad. Harold was our first choice, and I was amazed when he agreed to do it. It was a dream. Working together validated all the kinship I had felt with him as a kid. I always wanted to be a young Harold Ramis, and I literally got to be. Well, not literally, but in like a familial but also in a movie sense. Filming our father-son scene was one of the great joys of my life. Harold exuded such love and joy both on screen and off. His largely improvised wisdom was so nurturing and kind, I honestly think it's one of the reasons the movie functions. You see he's my father, and you think, this guy can't be that bad if that's who raised him. Maybe he can raise a baby. After we wrapped for the day, Harold came up to me and told me that when he wasn't in the same city as his kids, he gave himself permission to smoke weed, and he was wondering if I had any on me that I could give him. I weirdly didn't, but told him if he wanted to stop by my shitty West Hollywood apartment, I'd be more than happy to give him some. Shockingly, he said he would like that. He followed me home in his car, and I remember waiting nervously as he parked. I thought he'd just come and grab the tiny bag of weed I had prepared for him and bolt, presumably to go smoke it with someone way more cool than me. But when he got there, he just stood in my doorway and leaned against the wall, talking to me. For a while. Like a half an hour or 45 minutes, just talking. In no hurry, just happy to stand and smoke and shoot the shit. This might seem like a small thing, but to me, it was amazing and wonderful and something I still think about all the time. And everyone I know who knew Harold has a similar story. One of my good friends worked for Harold's agent for years and eventually left to get a better job with me. When he found out, Harold sent him a deep dish pizza from Chicago to congratulate him. I mean, I think of myself as a pretty nice guy, but I've never sent anyone food to celebrate a new job. But Harold would, and did. The world is better for having had him, and I'm honored to have existed at the same time as him. And I'm glad Violet asked me to write this foreword. I hope it's good. Thanks. Enjoy the rest of the book.
Introduction. Life is messy. I learned a thing or two about life from my dad, the late, great Harold Ramis. For those of you who knew him personally, I don't have to tell you what a sweet, generous, loyal, wise, supportive, and joyful person he was. For people familiar with him as a writer, director, and actor, his intelligence, humor, creativity, and subtly subversive worldview need no elaboration. For those of you who have no idea who he was or what he meant to the world of comedy filmmaking, I don't even know what to say. Congrats on escaping from the fallout shelter after all these years? Perhaps the simplest and most useful thing my father ever taught me was this. Life is messy. His life was surprisingly messy, which you wouldn't necessarily believe, considering what a neatnik he was. I mean, truly, not a goddamn thing out of place. But, as with everything else in his life, he rolled with the chaos and ultimately embraced it, and following his lead, so have I. One night, when I was about 23, I asked him what he thought signified adulthood. He took a thoughtful puff off the joint we were sharing and said, "Well, it's not about having a job or a family, because you can have those things and still be emotionally and intellectually a child. I think really, being an adult is about acknowledging ambiguity in all areas of life and finding a way to be okay with that." I guess I wasn't an adult yet, because even though I nodded sagely, I didn't have a clue what he was talking about. Now, 15 years, 3 kids, 3 stepkids, 1 baby daddy, and 1 husband later, I get it. Nobody really knows what they're doing. Bad things happen to good people. Great things happen to horrible people. Those horrible people were probably abused and neglected as children, so they're not really horrible anyway. Life is full of pain and suffering. Life is full of joy and wonder. There will be no final exam at the end of your life to tell you if you passed or failed. It's all a mess. Thanks, Dad. Cue grainy, sepia-toned nostalgia filter in 3, 2, 1. Harold Allen Ramis, a.k.a. Herschel, Hershey, and Hirsch, was born in Chicago on November 21st, 1944, to Ruth and Nathan Ramis, who ran a family grocery store on the west side. They lived with Ruth's mother, father, sister, and brother in a 2-bedroom apartment. Little Harold and his older brother, Stephen, started working, bagging and delivering groceries when they were about 8 years old and, famously in our family folklore, used their bar mitzvah money to buy their mother new wall-to-wall carpeting. My dad, nice Jewish boy that he was, wanted to be a neurosurgeon throughout high school and took German because it was the language of doctors. He started a little folk band, The Wanderers, with some friends when he was 14, so he wasn't shy about putting himself out there. But it wasn't until he went to Washington University in St. Louis in 1962 that his life started to deviate from the straight and narrow. In a talk my dad gave at the Chicago Humanities Festival in 2009, he said, "I started college looking like John Kennedy and finished college looking like John Lennon, with the politics of Nikolai Lennon." At Wash U, he joined a fraternity, ZBT, got more seriously into writing and acting and drugs, and married my mom, Anne, soon after graduation. Over the years, he evolved through many phases. There was the acid-dropping, pot-smoking, world-traveling draft dodger who worked in turn as an adult psychiatric worker in a mental hospital, migrant farm worker for a week, taxi driver, and guitar-strumming, idealistic inner-city substitute teacher. There was the ambitious young journalist by day, improv theater nerd by night, who became a Hollywood wunderkind and ultimately a founding father of modern comedy. There was the eager young husband and doting father who stuck it out for almost 20 years, but who eventually realized he wanted a different life, and so, at 45, married his former assistant and started a new family. There was the rabbi, the Buddhist, the philosopher, the philanthropist, the snob, the everyman, the heartthrob, the glutton, the grandfather, and on and on. The range of experiences he lived through informed his unique mix of mischief maker and mensch, and made him complex without being complicated. Clearly, my father was not a purist in any sense of the word. If Carl Sagan, Pema Chodron, Groucho Marx, and John Lennon had a baby, it might get close to the core elements of who he was. My dad was full of contradictions that he somehow managed to synthesize into a glorious whole person whom everyone admired, respected, and loved. I loved my dad more than anything in this world. Sorry, kids. And I believe he felt the same way about me. In 2007, we started talking about writing a book together on parenting. Existential parenting, to be exact. Our working title was, "We're All Gonna Die, Now Go to Sleep," which should give you an idea of the tone we were going for. In spite of my bizarre Hollywood childhood, I turned out to be a generally well-adjusted, productive person, and I wanted to know what the secret to that was. Did the parenting even matter, or are we just born who we are? While starting to brainstorm on this project, my dad and I talked about how different my childhood was from his son's and how he thought that might play out. We talked about my kids and what core values I wanted to impart to them. We mused on questions like, how do you teach your children to be engaged, optimistic, and hopeful when the world sucks and we all die alone in the end? I wish so much that we had written that book. I wish so many things. But he got sick and died. And here I am with all of these memories and stories and lessons that need to be shared. And since one lesson he taught me was to live without regrets, I don't want to waste another minute pining for what might have been. This is the way life went, and I am trying to accept it. If you had done things differently, he would say, you wouldn't be who you are today. So if you're relatively happy with where you are, congratulations. Enjoy it. You're one of the fortunate ones. Whatever mistakes you think you made are what brought you to this point, and it seems like a pretty sweet spot. So, lucky me for having him as my dad, and lucky you for listening to this and getting to know him through my eyes. August 15th, 2014. Dear Dad, so you're dead. Now what? I don't think I'd ever seen that SCTV sketch before. But during the Harold Ramis Love Fest right after you died, people were posting it all over the place. Now what indeed? I read somewhere that letter writing is a good way to help with the grieving process, so I'm going to try to write to you instead of just wallowing in my sadness. We'll see. It's been almost 6 months since you've been gone, and I think about you all the time, Daddy. In some ways, it's like you're with me now more than you were before. I'm flooded with memories and stories and images and questions. It's like everywhere I look, there you are. Walking through a bookstore, I see a table of books that I know you read, and I want to talk to you about all of them. Your movies have been on TV a lot, and I remember how, when TiVo came out, you were so excited to be able to see any time one of them was on. Hey, this gives the search for self a whole new meaning, you said. The world is seeming crazier and crazier, and I want to talk to you about politics and police brutality and Robin Williams and the Middle East and gun control and being Jewish. Where are you? I need you. Some guys painted a great mural of you as Egon in downtown LA, and somebody in Brooklyn is spray painting your name all over the city. So many people have made amazing little tributes to you online, and when I can't sleep at 2 a.m., I'm obsessively combing through Instagram and Twitter for new posts. I don't know if you have social media where you are, but if you do, hashtag Harold Ramis is the most obvious tag. However, you can also find yourself under hashtag super sexy Jew hunk. How funny is that? If you were still here, I would have made you a t-shirt. Julian also found a website called F Yeah Harold Ramis, which is pretty sweet. I know it seems silly that I take so much comfort and enjoyment from these little things, but if people who didn't even really know you are heartbroken and mourning, then it's okay that I am too, right? On top of missing you like crazy, I'm also feeling a lot of anxiety about loss. I already lost you, and now I'm afraid I'm gonna lose all of the you that's such a huge part of me. I mean, if you're not here, then who am I? How can I preserve what we had when I'm alone? I don't want to forget a single thing about you.
It's all I have now. I love you so much, Violet. Young love. Let's start at the beginning, my beginning, with the story of Harold and Anne. My parents first officially met in San Francisco during the summer of 1966. They both attended Washington University, and my dad knew my mom peripherally as the beautiful girl who had briefly dated two of his roommates. After one of them came home from a hayride with my mom, my dad asked, "How was it?" "Weird," the friend said. "Weird? Really? How?" He was intrigued. "Well," the guy said, "she only spoke in quotes from Billy Budd the whole time." Oddly, my dad thought, "I gotta meet this girl." My mom was vaguely aware of my dad from his college theater work, most notably his role as the priest of Zeus in Oedipus Rex, and writing and performing in several fraternity-related shows. The summer after he graduated in 1966, my dad headed west with his brother Stephen and college friend David. Soon after arriving in San Francisco, they ended up at the apartment where my mom was staying with two of her girlfriends. He described first seeing her intently watching the Dybbuk, a 1937 Yiddish-language Polish fantasy film drama, on a TV so staticky you could barely make out the picture. He tried casually chatting with her, but she shushed him, leaning closer to the TV. Despite this, he thought she was interesting and beautiful and decided to ask her out for Friday night. "I can't," she told him. "I'm seeing the Bolshoi Ballet." "Okay, then. How about Saturday?" "I can't. I'm seeing the Bolshoi Ballet." She had bought tickets for the whole run, but agreed to go out with him the following week. He knew she was different from other girls he dated, but I don't think he realized just quite how different she was until they started spending more time together. One day, after my mom and dad had gone out a few times, they were listening to music in her room when, out of nowhere, she slapped him hard across the face. He dramatized this encounter in an autobiographical script he wrote called To Be or Not To Be, about his early 20s. As of now, the screenplay remains unproduced. Interior, Jane's house. It's a rambling Victorian with high ceilings, lots of woodwork, reasonably well maintained. Her roommates, Hayes and Ginger, are watching TV and reading in the living room, which is nicely decorated with inexpensive thrift shop furniture, colorful French posters, and cheap Asian folk art. Jane leads Julian into her bedroom. Cut to interior Jane's room. Julian has never seen anything like it. The decor is a cross between an Edwardian boudoir and a harem, a mad mix of Indian cloth, lace, floral prints, an oriental rug, Moroccan leather ottoman, colorfully painted camel skin lamps with beautiful fringed silk scarves artfully draped over them, ostrich feathers, an Art Nouveau writing desk, and in the center of the room, a graceful turn-of-the-century chaise longue. Julian: "Wow, incredible." Jane, lighting candles: "Do you want to sit down?" Julian: "Sure." He looks around and sits on the chaise. The room smells like it looks, like an exotic potpourri. Jane puts on a record, a beautiful aria. Julian: "Opera. Cool." Jane: "You like it?" Julian: "I don't know. I haven't heard that much." Jane: "Well, give it a try. I'm just gonna change. One second." She disappears behind a lacquered three-panel Chinese screen. Julian, looking around: "Where's your bed?" Jane, from behind the screen: "You're sitting on it." Julian: "The sofa? Chaise?" She emerges from behind the screen wearing an exotic floor-length flowing white robe embroidered with red roses. Jane: "It's not really a chaise. It's called a fainting couch." Julian, regarding her robe: "That's incredible." Jane: "I just got it. It's from India." She sits next to him. "Look at this needlework." She gathers the skirt and lays the silken folds in his hands for him to see. Jane: "It's done by children in villages so poor they never know if they'll even have anything to eat, but somehow they manage to do this beautiful work. I think that's so tragic." Her eyes fill with tears. Julian doesn't know what to say. Julian: "Are you okay?" Jane: "Yes, I'm just sad. How can life be so cruel?" Really weeping now. Julian tentatively puts his arm around her shoulders, trying to be comforting, but feeling helpless. Julian, can I get you anything? Jane stops crying. No, thank you. I don't want you to think that you have to fix everything for me. It's okay to be sad sometimes. There are real things in life to be sad about. Julian, I know. They look into each other's eyes, then Julian slowly leans in and kisses her tenderly. After a moment, their lips part, and he sits back, still gazing into her eyes. Suddenly, she slaps him surprisingly hard across the face. Julian, shocked and angry. What was that for? Jane, I don't know. Julian, baffled. You don't know? Was it because I kissed you? Jane, I don't think so. I liked it. Julian, did I do something wrong? Jane, I don't know. Did you? Julian stares at her, really indignant, but not sure why. Julian, that was very weird. Jane, don't you think you're making an awfully big deal about a little slap? Julian, it hurt. Jane, that bad? Julian, no, it was just surprising, that's all. Jane, maybe that's a good thing. Julian, yeah, well, hitting me with a chair would be surprising too, but I don't think it would be a good thing. What were you thinking? Jane, I don't know, that I wanted to slap you. I'm not angry, I'm not offended or insulted. Does there have to be a reason? He looks at her for a moment. Julian, just tell me, are you going to be doing that again? Jane, do you want me to? Julian, no. Jane, then I won't. She looks deep into his eyes, then he leans forward and kisses her again, embracing her as they sink down onto the fainting couch. End scene. In case you haven't picked up on it yet, I'll just say that my mother, Anne, is a very unusual person. She grew up in a suburb of St. Louis with her parents, Rose and Harry, and her sister, Natalie, who was 1 year younger. Harry was a hard man who owned a few women's clothing stores and rode his wife and daughters mercilessly about their weight. Rose likely had undiagnosed depression or bipolar disorder, but loved her daughters to the point of worship and did her best to protect them from their father. My mom, angry at her dad, frustrated with her mom, and pitted against her sister, learned early on that living in her own world was her best bet for self-preservation. She threw herself into dance, art, and literature, and was uncompromising in her aesthetics. It makes perfect sense that my dad, an easygoing people-pleaser from the moment he was born, was attracted to this contrarian pixie who unapologetically pushed the limits and often buttons of everyone around her. Harold and Anne returned to St. Louis in the fall of 1966, my mom for her senior year of college and my dad for a postgraduate program he'd enrolled in but dropped out of after 2 weeks. My mom took her art history classes during the day and worked as an usher for the American Theater at night. Their courtship was uneventful, in a very 1966 way. A typical date could range from going to see the newest movie, to grabbing a pizza, to my dad and his friends taking LSD and my mom, stone sober, but with a naturally kaleidoscopic brain, leading them on an adventure through the city. Your mother almost never drank or took drugs, my dad told me, but everyone else did, and she was a great inspiration. I remember once, well, honestly, I don't really remember how we got there, but I know the night ended with a group of us in a little forest dancing around Anne like fairies in a Midsummer Night's Dream, and I'm pretty sure that wasn't the only time. The young couple met each other's parents, both sets approved, and things seemed to be getting more serious, but my mom continued to date other people and my dad started to worry that someone else was going to come in and swoop her up. In January of 1967, she invited my dad to join her as an usher for a production of The Mikado, and he proposed to her on opening night. She knew right away that she would say yes, but didn't give him an answer until the intermission. And so, 6 months later, on July 2nd, 1967, at the tender ages of 21 and 22, my parents were married in a traditional Jewish ceremony under a chuppah my dad had proudly built himself. My mom had her 7 bridesmaids wearing dresses from other formal occasions, and my dad's tux may or may not have had ruffles and bell-bottoms. About 150 guests, mostly made up of their college friends and my dad's family, attended the reception at the Bel Air Hotel in St. Louis. My mother, true to form, wanted pie instead of a standard wedding cake, so my dad ordered 20 chocolate pies from a local bakery. He entertained the guests while Mom sat raptly listening to the singer, Sid Selvage, an anthropology student from Memphis, perform an acoustic set of blues and folk songs. Sadly, there are no photos from this bizarre and blessed event because the photographer forgot to put film in the camera. Young, in love, and with nothing to lose, they stayed true to their Midwestern roots and moved back and forth between St. Louis and Chicago in their first few years together, following my dad's opportunities for work and my mom's interests for pleasure. They remained close with their core group of college friends, who were largely liberal Jewish artistic types. My parents weren't true hippies, but definitely leaned far to the left politically at the time. My dad dodged the Vietnam draft in late 1967 by telling the recruiters that he was a gay drug addict and taking a bunch of speed right before his appointment. He experimented with various types of work and occasionally got hired to sing and play guitar at parties. Though he was interested in pursuing writing and theater as possible careers, he hadn't quite figured out how to break into the creative world. At one point, early in my parents' marriage, he auditioned for a role in The Importance of Being Earnest, but was told that his looks were not Dresden enough, read too Jewish, so he didn't get the part. In spite of his slow start, my dad always credited my mom with pushing him outside his comfort zone and putting him on the path that eventually led to his success. The two instances he always cited in terms of my mother's instrumental role in his career trajectory were her encouragement to perform during open mic night at the Hungry Eye in San Francisco soon after they first met, and her challenge for him to submit a freelance article for the Chicago Daily News a few years into their relationship. "Why not?" was her response to his hesitation in both cases. My mom lives in a universe where there are no rules, where anything is possible, and the more unlikely something is, the better, which is the ideal mindset for a boundary-pushing creative. And this idea of rules being flexible carried over in all aspects of her life. Once, when my newlywed parents went shopping at the grocery store, my mom kept jumping out of the checkout line for one more thing. The lady behind them was getting frustrated and tried to scold my mom. "What if everyone did that?" she asked. "Well, if everyone did it, it would be socially acceptable," my mom snapped back, much to my dad's embarrassment and delight. I think he often walked the line between being deeply respectful of her intelligence and creative spirit and frustrated with her refusal to conform or compromise. As much as Dad may have appreciated my mom's extreme out-of-the-box thinking, neither one of them was particularly interested in dropping out and running away with the flower children. Despite their countercultural leanings, they were still just a couple of Midwestern middle-class Jewish kids trying to make their way, and somebody had to pay the bills. Don't go into retail. This was the only advice my grandfather ever gave my dad, and he took it very seriously. My dad had worked since he was a kid, bagging and delivering groceries in the family business and stocking shelves in a department store warehouse. But after he and my mom got married, he realized it was time to think about a career. Despite his college theater background and being a natural performer, my dad's path into the entertainment world was a meandering one. After trying grad school for a couple of weeks and realizing it wasn't for him, he went on to work several odd jobs, including taxi driver, adult psychiatric worker on a locked ward in the Jewish Hospital of St. Louis, and full-time substitute teacher in the Robert Taylor Homes on Chicago's South Side. In discussing his seven-month stint in the psych ward with Deba Kunk in a 1982 interview for On TV, he said, "I wanted to compare my own psychedelic, hallucinogenic experience to madness to see what the lines were. It was a great job for learning a lot quickly about people and about your own madness. You think twice before you say, 'I'm going crazy.'" While much of the work was depressing and serious, there were bright spots. In a 1984 Vanity Fair interview, he described a nonverbal patient who would respond to questions with bizarre hand gestures that looked like communication but weren't. "So," he said, "everyone assumed, well, it's madness. I took it as a put-on, and I started giving him hand gestures back that were even more ludicrous than his. It was when he laughed that I knew he was as aware as I was." By allowing himself to get on this person's level, my dad was able to connect with him in a way that others weren't. I think this ability to shift perspective and take an unexpected approach is part of what made him so successful in comedy and film, and everything he did, really. He brought a similar sensibility to teaching. Being a full-time substitute is everyone's worst nightmare, he said. You have these kids for one day, you don't know their names, so you only have what they tell you to go on. Every day I thought the most I could do in those circumstances was to teach them a moral lesson about justice or behavior. Rather than try to force something on them, I would try to field whatever it was that they were putting out. There would often, even at 10 years old, be a firebrand spokesman for the class who would attack you on racial issues, and in an articulate way, like a young Stokely Carmichael. So I'd try to deal with that in a humane and rational way. Or if they were into fun and seemed harmless, I'd try to foster it, just make them have the greatest day they ever had in school, so they'd go home and say, well, that was good, I'd like to go back tomorrow. Although Dad would have made a great psychiatrist or teacher, he was disheartened by his work in the trenches and started looking around for something more fun and creative. In 1967, after seeing a show at Second City with my mom, my dad thought, I could do that, and enrolled in their 12-week improv workshop. When a spot opened up in the Second City touring company, Dad auditioned but wasn't selected, so he went down the street to the Old Town Players Theater, where he taught improv and staged a small show with his class. Meanwhile, my mom was studying at the Art Institute, training with a Chinese dance troupe, and learning to macrame. She made my father a knotted vest that weighed about 20 pounds and painted the walls of their apartment in bright, contrasting colors. My dad, always so crafty, designed and constructed some of their furniture himself. A love seat, a rocking chair, a dining table, and an upholstered stepladder, which my mom then stained and lacquered. When I asked my mom, so the stepladder was for sitting? She answered matter-of-factly, yes, I always liked a bird's-eye view. Everything was at a different level in that apartment, so you could always have a distinct perspective. In a letter he wrote in 1968 to his college friend Nate Garland, my dad talked about the theater work he was doing prior to joining Second City and his growing desire for fame. May 18th, 1968. Dear Nate, nice to hear from friends in European countries, and we do enjoy your letters. Yale sounds like a guarantee of professional success and leads me to reaffirm my feelings about the possibility of knowing someone who does something important artistically. I've really got this thing in my mind about being famous, not purely for the gratification of fame, but for the opportunity to affect the aesthetic sensibilities of a mass audience. That's part of the attraction in theater form, and I expect that most artists feel somewhat the same way these days. My acting workshop is going quite well. I have 9 beginning actors, including Bogarty, and we just did a public performance of 5 one-acts that was pretty well received. I didn't know that people credit directors with so much influence, but after the plays, people were complimenting me en masse, which blew my ego all out of proportion. I loved it, though, but realized that acting had better come first before I can approach directing in a completely meaningful way. I don't know enough about the actual mechanics of acting, and so when we move to San Francisco in September, I'm going to try to get into a good formal acting conservatory. I've been really super conscious of furniture design since my own came to mind, and I'm really anxious to see yours. As for film, you might be interested to know that Mickey Friedman is making a film. He's casting for it now, and it sounds like a potentially good effort. Mickey Schamberg is also doing well now, writing full-time for The American and part-time for Time Life. I'm considering freelancing some things, but I have a laziness to fight that sometimes seems insurmountable. Anne's work at the Art Institute has been great. She's learned so much this semester and has been turning out consistently good paintings and drawings. I'll close now, so have a good time traveling and contact us when convenient. We enjoy hearing from you. Signed, Harold. Amid the dramatic social and political upheaval going on in Chicago in 1968, Dad attempted to focus his energy on sorting out his professional direction, chasing the entertainment business in a more direct way. He became a freelancer for the Chicago Daily News, writing music, movie, and theater reviews. Around the same time, he was asked to come back to Second City for a live onstage audition and was hired as a member of their new touring company. This is when he first met Brian Doyle Murray and Joe Flaherty, who both appeared in many of his films and remained close friends throughout his life. Once the company returned to Chicago after their first tour, Dad got himself hired as the party jokes editor at Playboy, which would be his day job through the remainder of the 60s and early 70s. He read through hundreds of joke submissions every week, surprised by how generally unoriginal most of them were. Talking about his time at Playboy, he said, "My defining moment was in the basement of the Grotto when it was on State Street. The entire cast of Hair was naked in the swimming pool singing Let the Sun Shine In. I was like, all right, it's not going to get better than this." In 1969, Bernie Sollins ushered in the next generation at Second City when he replaced the old resident company with my dad's touring company. Reflecting on this transition in the book, The Second City, backstage at the world's greatest comedy theater, my dad said, "The original companies of the late 50s and early 60s had been Freudian, alienated, post-war, beatnik, bohemian in their philosophy and outlook. We were political in a different way. We were radical, born out of the 1968 Chicago Convention. We looked like the guys who were in the streets getting clubbed by the police, but we weren't really in the streets." Even though my dad was too timid to actually put himself on the front line for a cause, he was considered to be one of the most political people in their social circle and was often ribbed for it. "It was always your boys with Joe Flaherty," my dad once recalled to me laughing. "Whenever there was civil unrest, and there was a lot of it back then, Joe would come in with his newspaper and say, 'Well, Harold, your boys in Madrid are at it again.' Or, 'Tell your boys in California to unchain themselves from those bulldozers and get a job.'" So while my father may have been a radical at heart, he was also an ambitious young performer and libertine who didn't seem to let political sympathies interfere with having fun. I remember him in tears from laughing so hard, telling me a story about the ingenious and infamous Del Close, who had vomited on his cat, decided it would be a good idea to take the cat into the shower to clean up, and was shredded to ribbons by said cat. But it wasn't all sunshine and applause, and my dad's crazy schedule of 9 to 5 at Playboy and 6 shows per week at Second City started to take its toll on my parents' marriage. In 1984, he told Vanity Fair, "Anne was trying to live her life. She's much too bright, interested, and interesting to want to hang around the theater and watch me get famous, you know? So, without any guilt, she posed the question of whether we could actually have a life together. And I realized that it was a whole other major life question that I'd been ignoring. I really did believe in having a relationship with another person, as opposed to living my life entirely for myself and my career. And it bothered me how one could become so addicted to all the peripherals of being on stage, the groupies, the needing to be famous. I just saw myself perpetuating this terrible adolescent fear of not being popular because I felt like a geek or a nerd. Because I didn't want to succeed or fail in life based on whether I could make an audience like me. I actually feel that if I'd gone the other way, if I hadn't stayed so strongly committed to my marriage, they might have found me in a swimming pool face down." So, he quit his jobs and they set off on their first major adventure. My mother had first read about the Greek island of Idra in the liner notes of one of Leonard Cohen's first albums. Cohen was living there, on and off, and she became fixated on going there to meet him and experience his inspiration firsthand. According to her, the decision to actually go to Idra was made one night in Chicago when she and my dad took a bunch of acid. Not normally one to indulge in the readily available smorgasbord of substances, my mom had taken the drugs on a full stomach, felt horrible, and started to have a bad trip. My dad called Corky the Clown, a local figure who is known within their social circle to moonlight as an LSD guide. The clown fed my mom some maple syrup, talked her down, and left the young couple happily tripping and optimistically planning their future. "It was great," my mom said. "We were like tiny amoebas in this giant world. Amoebas with big dreams." So they started in France and rode the Orient Express, ending up on the rocky island of Idra in January of 1970. Once there, they fell in with a group of international bohemians, including Cohen, and spent months lounging around in crumbling cottages and crowded cafes, talking about art, movies, and poetry. My mom had listened to Greek language records for months leading up to their early visits, but still had no idea what she was saying, as she parroted phrases like, "Excuse me, Captain, may I have this dance?" My dad, on the other hand, had an ear for languages and would eagerly greet the locals with, "Hello, Greece is a wonderful country," in Greek, of course. At first, the local women thought my mother was a witch and crossed themselves every time she walked by. The yayas eventually came around, but my mom was indifferent. She just knew she immediately felt at home there. She liked the rocky isolation of the island in winter as much as the warmth of the spring social scene. My dad enjoyed Idra, but never really fell in love with it the way my mom did. When their money ran out a year later, they returned to Chicago, and my dad went back to Second City in 1971. It was then that he first met John Belushi, who had joined the company in my dad's absence. My dad was excited to be back in Chicago and working with his old friends, but started to realize that he was probably better suited to writing and directing than acting. He described this transition in Sheldon Patinkin's The Second City. "Every time we'd be improvising, the director would say, 'Stop writing, just go with what's happening.' I couldn't resist it, because you'd be improvising and the person you might be improvising with would go off on some idiotic tangent that you couldn't imagine. You knew what you wanted them to say, but I couldn't psychically influence what was happening on stage. I loved the process of improv, but as soon as I had the opportunity, I started writing what everyone else was going to say." My mom, in her way, remained captivated by Idra and returned there a few years later alone, while my dad worked. This was typical of their atypical relationship, giving each other space to pursue their individual interests and probably contributed to the longevity of their marriage as well as to its eventual ending. In any case, their distance necessitated a lot of letter writing, a lovely example which I've included here. Toots sweet. It's Wednesday afternoon, and I'm at the theater waiting for rehearsal to begin. I improvised for the first time last night, and it didn't go too badly. I wasn't overly frightened or desperate, nor did I feel that I had to pander to the audience. Also, I was sort of funny. The cast right now is a little short on ideas, but I've got plenty, plus enough influence and energy to implement them, I hope. We won't have the kind of lively togetherness we once had as a cast. Brian is obviously needed, but it can be fun. I see John Belushi some outside the theater, but he's a bit incoherent for me to really be close to him at this point. Joe is a little tired of work, and Judith is trying to get him to quit, so his work here suffers a little for it. But I think he's excited to have me back, as is Fisher, so maybe things will pick up for them. Dear, the only thing I'll be lacking here is you. I'm lonely when I'm alone and really not satisfied with the relationships at hand. There's something about having you around that makes life a little healthier for me. In short, I think I need you to take care of me. Ironic, isn't it? Maybe it's not so much that I need you with me, it's that I want you with me. How is it being without me? Miss me? Are you forgetting what I look like? Do you feel distant? No pun intended. Please write about us, and news, too. Not much news here. Brian called me. He's slightly depressed over lack of work in L.A. Maybe he'll come back. By the way, I talked to your dad and Rose on the phone instead of going to St. Louis. Your father is reluctant to provide money until he's sure we're committed to Idra and not just going through a phase. He's not angry or negative, though, just cautious. You can write him yourself if you want to. I'll close and write again soon. I love you with every part of my being and dream of our happy reunion. Bless you. Harold. My mom returned to Chicago and rejoined the circus of my dad's Second City life in 1973. Soon after, John Belushi brought my dad to New York in 1974 to write and perform with the National Lampoon Radio Hour and Lemmings Touring Company. John, Doug Kenny, Joe Flaherty, Chevy Chase, Gilda Radner, and the Murray brothers, Bill and Brian, rounded out the group. What an amazing time that must have been. Watching the documentary, Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead, about this era at the Lampoon, I was struck by how different things were during that time. It seems like a small miracle in and of itself that this ragtag group of freakish theater nerds and upstart intellectuals ever found each other, but it's even more amazing that they were able to let their collective genius coalesce into an entirely new form of body and brilliant socio-political comedy. While the Lampoon style of subversive comedy isn't exactly on par with the invention of the wheel or development of the polio vaccine, it did change the world in its way, and I'm very proud that my dad was such a big part of it. speaking to journalist Mark Caro about my dad for the Chicago Tribune in 1999, Second City founder Bernie Solon said, "I always knew that Harold would be an important factor in American comedy. He has all the skills and abilities to be funny and to write funny, but he's also a leader and a very nice guy. He was always looked up to in Second City and to being head writer at SCTV. He was never separate from anybody. He was always one of the boys, but he was the best boy." Dad kept himself busy writing the script for Animal House with Doug Kenny and Chris Miller and was offered the position of head writer for SCTV in 1976. Many of the Lampoon people had gone on to work for Saturday Night Live, but my dad declined. In an interview with Brett Martin for GQ, he said, "Lorne Michaels offered me a job, but at that point, I was the head writer on SCTV. SNL was completely fueled by cocaine. The show was being written literally overnight. I didn't want to stay up all night writing. And the show had a veneer of New York sophistication, very snide and superior. I thought, it's just not me." SCTV was the brainchild of Second City Toronto producer Andrew Alexander and writer and improv god Del Close, among others. With the exception of my dad, the original cast, John Candy, Andrea Martin, Dave Thomas, Joe Flaherty, Catherine O'Hara, and Eugene Levy, had all been culled from the stage at Second City Toronto. The premise of the show, a day in the life at the world's smallest television station, allowed for an almost endlessly eclectic mix of characters and setups. Talk shows, game shows, kids shows, news broadcasts, movies, and commercials, for ridiculous, non-existent products, of course, were interlaced with behind-the-scenes footage from the fictional small-town network. Dad performed a lot in the first 10 episodes, which are unfortunately not included in any of the re-released DVD sets and are not consistently available online. Some of his more memorable characters include station manager Mo Green, Officer Friendly, Alan Crazy Legs Hirschfeld, and Swami Banananada. I even make an appearance in a commercial for Tiny Tops, Wigs for Bald Babies. Your friends won't ask if it's a boy or a girl anymore when she sports the Dolly Parton top. After the first season wrapped, the SCTV cast rented a house in Bel Air for the summer and wrote the second season of shows. We wrote about 16 shows in 7 weeks. It was one of the happiest times of my life because they were all so funny and generous and talented in their work, my dad later said. Watching an early episode recently, I was blown away by how ahead of its time the show was and how prescient my dad and the other writers were about some of the more unsavory directions U.S. culture and politics would take. From Second City to Playboy, National Lampoon to SCTV, my dad could not have asked for a better foundation of comedy credentials, or better comrades, for that matter. So many of the people he connected with in his 20s remained important in his life for the duration. The lessons he learned from Del and Bernie stayed with him forever. Work from the top of your intelligence, and focus on making the other guy look good, were always his mottos. Although he sometimes projected a sort of indifference to ambition and success, he took his comedy seriously, and people took him seriously in turn. As his career began to really take off, his personal life also flourished as I prepared to make my big debut, springing like Athena from my father's head, fully formed, armed, and ready to take on the world. Harold plus Anne equals Violet. When my parents decided to have a baby, it was like a big experiment. They didn't read any parenting books or agonize about whether or not they were ready or worry about what stroller to buy. They just did it. My dad had a pretty happy childhood by all accounts, and he always knew he wanted to be a father. My mother, with her more complicated family history, had just accepted that she would never be a typical maternal type, but was game for the adventure nonetheless. I always loved hearing my dad tell the story of my birth every year on my birthday. They were living in a tiny house on Amelia Street in the Cabbage Town section of Toronto, watching Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, when my mom's water broke with a surprisingly loud pop. It was snowing. They took a cab to the hospital. My mom's regular OB, Dr. Bean, was on vacation, so Dr. Licorice stepped in to handle the delivery. My dad hated to see my mom in pain and felt so relieved when she finally got an epidural and started smiling again. After a couple of hours of unsuccessful pushing, the doctor started to worry, so he used forceps, and a foot on the edge of the bed to bring me into the world. The umbilical cord was wrapped around my neck twice, and I was very blue. My dad held his breath while they worked on me, and then wept when I finally started crying. "Oh, it was great," my mom recalls. "You weren't breathing, so they gave you oxygen, and then you pinked up and just stared into my eyes. All babies should get oxygen when they're born. I think that's why you're so smart." "Thanks, Mom." They had decided on Violet Isadora for a girl and Nikolai for a boy, but my mom used to always say that the name runner-ups were Sleeveless and Cinderello. About a week after I was born, my mom developed an infection and had to go back to the hospital. I was readmitted with her, but she really wasn't able to take care of me. My dad took care of both of us, and then, even after she recovered, he just kept on taking care of me. My mom was not what I would call an instinctive nurturer and wasn't comfortable with me as an infant. She didn't have any friends in Toronto outside of SCTV, and everyone was rehearsing and writing all day. She felt trapped, isolated, and unsure of herself as a mother. Unfortunately, postpartum depression was not acknowledged or understood at that time, so she would suffer through the days until my dad came home, at which time she would basically throw me into his arms and run out of the house. My dad, in his natural, easy way, just stepped in and took over as primary parent. He was nurturing, was affectionate, and loved to nap, a perfect match for a baby. Well, my mom thought, "Well, he can do this part, and I'll jump back in when she can talk." He was fine with the extended nonverbal communication. He could goo-goo ga-ga all day, and believe me, he did. It wasn't that my mom didn't care about me. I know she did, in her way. Her way, however, just didn't have that cocoony feeling of security and warmth that kids want and need. There were times in my life when I resented her for this lack of nurturing, but thankfully, she picked the right partner to smooth out her sharp corners, and she and I have a great relationship now. Still, I think what allowed me to be okay with what my mom couldn't give was what my dad always gave, the message I got from him from the day I was born until the day he died. "I'm here for you. I am yours. You are loved." After the second season of SCTV wrapped, and just before my first birthday, Harold and Anne returned to Edra with baby Violet and a full-time babysitter in tow. In the following 1978 letter to their good friends, the Gricos, my dad reflects on parenting and his career. February 3rd, 1978. "Dear Joe, Marcia, and Adrian, Anne and I are now on the island ferry on the way back to Edra after a sparkling 2 days in Athens. 2 days sans infant, I might add. The sweet Violet was left in the capable hands of her babysitter, a stout 20-year-old from Maine who now lives with us. We treated ourselves to first-class accommodations in celebration of me finishing the first draft of my new film, Untitled Moneymaker. It is untitled so far, but I can tell you it's a sword and sorcery fantasy epic comedy. I may be in L.A. in March to do the rewrite. Anyway, Animal House, the Lampoon film, is shot, edited, and loved by Universal. They've booked it into the best Westwood and New York theaters for a summer opening. I'm told it will be the takeoff, breakthrough hit of the post-war years, possibly the triumph of the century. I'm told this by the producer. Ah, well, we'll see. Joe, why are your letters funnier than my screenplays? We loved your last one. It really brings sweet memories of you all to us. What a bad sentence, you all to us. You know what I mean, though. We're awfully fond of you. Edra is beautiful and boring. Boring to me, that is. Anne is in constant rapture about being there. She wants me to buy a house on the island. I will if I can, but I can only see living there a few months a year. The winter, especially December, was awful. Very cold, very windy, rough seas. Hence, no ferry boat for 4 days. The Greeks were already figuring out which foreigners to eat first if the groceries ran out. But it's warm and nice now. The house we're in is a palace, but it's on a hilltop, 400 steps up from the port. I counted them. But we're moving to Kamani, to a sunnier lower house. Kamani, you'll recall, is the little village attached to Edra with its own little beach. We'll keep the same mailing address, so don't scratch us out of your address book. Violet is great. Cute, big, smart, jolly. All the things you'd want in a dog. She may walk soon, has 8 teeth, some hair, and an infectious grin. She also sleeps until 9 a.m., her most endearing trait. Anne has taken a vacation from motherhood. She loves Violet. Violet loves her. But Anne leaves all the chores and responsibility to me and Lori, the babysitter. It's all right with me, though. She had a rough time with Violet in Canada while I was off at work every day, and at least she isn't abusive to her. I'm sure they'll be friends when Violet is old enough to help take care of Anne. So, as I near the end of the page, I'll hope that you're thriving and happy. I know you've got enough water now, and I can picture the nice mild winter you must be having. Look for us in the spring, and write again if you can. Love, Harold. And ditto, Anne. When Joe sent me this letter in 2016, I have to admit, I sobbed after reading it. Not because it was sad or surprising, but because it so perfectly validated my understanding of my parents and our strange little family. My dad's wisdom, generosity, and humor were evident as he matter-of-factly recounted the mundane news of our lives alongside the personal challenges we faced. That my mom agreed and was okay with his sharing these intimate details is also a telling expression of her peculiarity. They were who they were, and they accepted it and loved each other in spite of it. And there I was, the bouncing baby girl, in a castle on a hill, waiting for my parents to come and get me for our next adventure. National Lampoon's Animal House, 1978. Written by Harold Ramis, Doug Kenny, and Chris Miller. Directed by John Landis. Awkward college freshman Larry, Tom Hulse, and Kent, Stephen First, attempt to pledge the elitist Omega Theta Pi house, but are unceremoniously rejected. After reevaluating their options and adjusting their standards, they move on to the infamously irreverent Delta Tau Chi house. As the Deltas put their pledges to various depraved tests of brotherhood, the college dean, John Vernon, conspires with the Omegas to have Delta's charter revoked. Otter. Bluto's right. Psychotic, but right. I think the situation absolutely requires a really futile and stupid gesture to be done on somebody's part. Bluto. And we're just the guys to do it. The Lampoon people understand the darkest secret of an American college education. One of the noblest reasons to go is to spend 4 years studying sex. Frank Rich, Time. National Lampoon's Animal House is by no means one long howl, but it's often very funny, with gags that are effective in a dependable, all-purpose way. Janet Maslin, New York Times. The movie is vulgar, raunchy, ribald, and occasionally scatological. It finds some kind of precarious balance between insanity and accuracy. Between cheerfully wretched excess and an ability to reproduce the most revealing nuances of human behavior. Roger Ebert, Chicago Sun-Times. The idea for Animal House was born out of the National Lampoon 1964 high school yearbook parody, published in 1973, although the content is unrelated. My dad had met Doug Kenny, one of the founders of National Lampoon, when he joined the National Lampoon Radio Hour, and the two hit it off immediately. My dad adored Doug, and their creative work thrived in partnership. They elevated each other's strengths and provided unique perspectives to enhance the overall appeal of their work. He told Tad Friend for The New Yorker in 2001, "Doug used to say that just because something's popular doesn't mean it's bad, which I really took to heart because my stance had always been that people are idiots and sheep. Our other motto was, broad comedy is not necessarily dumb comedy." The first product of their partnership was a script called Laser Orgy Girls, a comedy about aliens and Charles Manson as a high school student. Lampoon producers Maddie Simmons and Ivan Reitman liked the screenplay, but asked them to go back, rein it in a little, and move the story to college. They brought in another Lampoon writer, Chris Miller, and the three of them spent weeks writing down every funny college experience they'd had or heard about. It was truly a collaborative process. They each wrote a third of the script and then rotated, so everyone rewrote everyone's work. Intoxicated by the combination of arrogance, intelligence, and youth, among other things, Dad, Doug, and Chris were convinced they were creating a masterpiece while writing Animal House. It's difficult to imagine now, but what they were doing in terms of elevating the underdogs and vilifying the golden boys hadn't been done before. Good was good and bad was bad, from the perspective of the white mainstream anyway. Somehow, Doug, Chris, and Dad just knew that their new take would work. In a 1999 interview with the AV Club, Dad said, "When Universal read the first drafts of Animal House, executive Ned Tannen said, 'Wait a minute, these guys are the heroes?' He didn't get it, but we knew that our generation would get it completely." Much like the protagonist,